Hello, I am Joshua P. Warren, and this is Joshua P. Warren Daily. Last month, June 1st of 2018, I was contacted by a Silicon Valley engineer named Ronald Heath, and he told me that he had created a meter for the guy who has every other meter. It's called a DT meter, which stands for the differential time rate meter. Now, Ronald said he was inspired by an episode of The X-Files in which Mulder syncs up two stopwatches and then takes one to a UFO hotspot. Afterward, Mulder compares the two and finds they are different. Hence, something in the space-time environment had changed. So Ronald Heath created the DT meter to provide the same kind of feedback. It's a device that is comparing two points and the timing of a signal traveling between those two points. Now, Ronald honored me with being the first field investigator to try out his new invention, and I found the time anomaly, according to the DT meter, on June 18th, 2018, in the desert just north of Las Vegas, Nevada. I found out later that this spot just so happens to also be a UFO hotspot, where astounding footage of strange lights have been filmed by researchers like Steve Barone, and at least one man, Sean Kevin Jason, had a full-blown close encounter with a huge triangular craft back in 1996. My finding made international news, and in countless interviews, I have been asked for more information about the inventor of the DT meter and how the device works. Therefore, I could not be more pleased to present this conversation with the man behind the machine. Ronald Heath, welcome to the show.
Hey, Justin, it's a real honor to be on the show, and that's pretty exciting.
Well, you know, I don't think either one of us foresaw this, did we, how all this was going to turn out, right?
No way. That's pretty great development. I let's congratulate on finding the anomaly. That's incredible.
Well, you know, thank you for everything. I mean, again, it was very serendipitous how all this worked out because, as you've heard me say, I was looking for some reason to go to Area 51 anyway. And when you contacted me about your new device, I knew that, oh, yeah, this is something that needs to be taken to that spot. And so, you know, what's funny is I've done so many interviews now with people all over certainly the country and even the world about the finding, and sometimes people want to talk to me more about my opinion on, you know, what this means and theories and all that kind of stuff. But sometimes people want to get even more technical and they want to know more about the device. And so in this conversation, I mean, I think we should let everybody know that it's okay if we get a little technical. We're going to geek out a little bit and, you know, trying to get into some of the details and specifics for those who want to know exactly, you know, how this works. But let's just begin with you, Ronald. So tell me a little bit about where you're from, where you are, and the path that you've taken throughout your life.
Okay. Well, I've always been interested in electronics or since a very young age, and I spent 4 years in the Navy a long time ago, and the last 20 years or so I've been an electronics engineer in Silicon Valley, and I always have side projects going on, and a number of these involved various types of UFO detectors, and the Mulder episode was really a great inspiration. I was looking for a detector that would have no false alarms. The magnetic detectors presently, you know, they detect passing trucks and stuff like that. But the time rate, we don't have any technology that's available, textbook that could cause a difference in time rate, a measurable 100 feet away. So that's what I built.
And so now you live in California right now. Are you from California?
Yeah, I lived here all my life.
Okay. And so and do you mind telling everybody roughly what age you are?
Well, I'll say that that I just retired last week.
Okay. Well, congratulations on that. All right. And so, and the reason I ask is because I want to make it clear just how long that you have been doing this kind of work and the exposure you've had to how technology has evolved. And so throughout most of your life to make a living, I mean, what are the kinds of projects specifically that you've worked on? I know you've done work with LEDs, for example. I don't know if you feel comfortable mentioning the names of any companies, but, you know, how much detail can you tell us about your resume?
Okay. Well, my day job always involves designing and building small add-on circuits for larger machines. I've designed circuits for mass spectrometers and electron beam lithography, and I can't really go into specifics about what exactly they're working on because mostly they're R&D projects.
Okay. And so basically when you show up for work, I mean, do you have just a little table and you just sit down there and you're surrounded by just tons of circuits and a soldering iron? Or like, what does your workspace look like on most of the time throughout your life? What does that workspace look like?
Well, I usually have both a cube and a lab. I have the cube has the computer and normal papers and stuff, and the lab has the soldering iron and test equipment, and we go back and forth between the two.
And how did you learn to do all this? Did you go to school, or are you self-taught? I mean, what's your educational status?
I've been educated in both different ways. When I was a kid, very young, I broke open electron tubes and find out what's inside. And a teenager, I made electronic projects I probably shouldn't mention, but they caused interference on the TVs in the area.
Right. Done that too. I know what you mean.
Okay. But when I was right out of school, I went into the Navy and learned computers in there and machine language programming. And I was on a ship for a while maintaining data entry consoles. And got out of the Navy and went to work in, as a technician for years and put myself through night school and became an engineer.
So most of your formal education came from the Navy then, is that right?
That's right, and coursework.
Mm-hmm. And so did you work on things that were classified? What can you talk about some of the things you did in the Navy?
Well, yeah. I was a technician. I maintained radar tracking display consoles that entered data into a computer system for tracking and fire control.
Okay.
At this time, it's no longer classified.
Yeah, amazing how that happens, isn't it? You know, as time goes on and the technology explodes. Was there some kind of experience that inspired your interest in UFOs? Or, I mean, where does that come from?
My grandfather saw one, and ever since then, it's kind of been in the back of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I've always not really had too much trust in what I was being taught, as far as especially physics. So I was always looking for a way to detect to see if anyone actually else had the technology that in theory should exist.
And you know, in preparation for this interview, you sent me some pictures to sort of give me an idea of various prototypes that you made for this meter that is now becoming world famous. And you've been working on this for a long time. I think you said you attempted it for the first time in 2004 with a big, bulky looking contraption. Is that right?
Yeah, that was the first one. There was a 9500 series from Xilinx FPGA. I mean, I'm getting way technical probably, but they were cheap chips, and they had a large amount of area to program the as far as logic. And I combined that with a demo board for something called a Rabbit processor, and it worked, but at that time the technology wasn't up to it to make a product that was cheap enough to sell. And I didn't make it for that. I made it to do other experiments that I was working on at the time.
So now you've heard me give all these interviews and try to explain to people the concept behind the DT meter. I even sort of did it in your intro here, but let's hear it in your words. I mean, tell everybody, you know, what is the concept behind the DT meter and how this thing works?
Okay. The concept is that you have an oscillator that's a distance away, and you have a local oscillator, and then you have a computer that counts the pulses fast at a fast enough rate to give you a good resolution. So this computer counts every pulse that's coming in from the detector unit, and it compares the count with the internal oscillator. Both oscillators are from the same company, they have the same specs, and there should be no difference other than the temperature variation. So since it's a digital count, and the microcontroller is very reliable, there should never ever be a difference. So I count the difference and display it on the screen. And
Okay.
the whole concept is that from a lot of evidence that main scientists wouldn't stand up to scientific scrutiny possibly, there must be time anomalies. There's been too many reports. So my main goal in 2004 was to build a device that would cause a time anomaly. Of course, have not quite been yet successful in this yet.
Yeah, it's a little different to detect one versus to create one, right?
Right. Yeah.
Well, in fact, it's kind of funny because I now that you're making a small batches of these, one researcher contacted me who I think he didn't understand exactly what the purpose of the device is, and he was asking me how he travels through time with it, and I said, I don't, it's not a time machine, but it might help you find a place where you can increase the odds of having a time anomaly experience. Okay, so what? By the way, that was a great description. Now, I was on a national radio program the other night. Hal just mentioned it. I was on Ground Zero with Clyde Lewis, and he asked me, how is this device calibrated? And I said, well, look, because I didn't make it, I don't want to talk about calibration because I'm afraid I might say something that's inaccurate. So let me pose that question to you, and I think you already kind of just answered it, but let's reinforce this. When somebody says, "How do you calibrate a device that is supposed to measure a time anomaly?" What did you do there to calibrate this thing?
Okay. Normal operation in the field, you need to have both the sensor and the display unit close to each other. And then when you power up, the computer that's inside the display unit will assume that the local oscillator is correct, and it will measure out a second. During that second, it will be counting the pulses from the sensor unit. And then it will take the difference and store that difference and say, okay, it's zero now. There's no difference in time rate between the sensor and the display unit. Okay, and then it will continue on with that same calibration until the next power up.
Okay. And so essentially, like you said, we have really two chips that are just like little clocks, right? They're like high precision clocks, and they sync up when you turn the thing on. If you follow the instructions, you know they sync up. They compare oscillations and they count that as the zero reference point. And then when you move the sensor away 100 feet, that's when you look for some kind of a difference between the two. And you even mentioned also in the instructions that, you know, it'd be a lot easier if you didn't have a cable, but it's a lot more reliable to have the 100-foot cable, right?
That's right. I think you noticed in your second trip that it was not affected by lightning. And the reason is because the cable itself is shielded, and it's terminated with a 75-ohm matching impedance at the display unit so that the signal arrives cleanly and protected from the outside influences of the EMI interference.
Well, I'm glad you pointed that out because, you know, I've mentioned to people who are understandably critical of my finding and skeptical and all that, I've told them, like, look, yes, this is an anomaly. That's what I've always called it. So, I mean, that means it's something out of the ordinary, but it's still the first stage in this very long new adventure of plotting points. But to make sure everybody understands, I have now used this meter under various extreme circumstances, both night and day. I mean, here in Las Vegas, more often than not, I've used it when it's 100 to 110 degrees. I have used it in the middle of a raging thunder and lightning storm. I have video footage of that on my website. And extreme heat and extreme lightning didn't make any kind of a difference. I mean, I'm sitting there watching the thing with lightning bolts striking and nothing's happening. In fact, it was really kind of dumb and risky for me to do that, but I did. And then, you know, again, you look at these extreme temperature differences, and I know that you, as a guy who thinks scientifically, you you're already, you know, saying, like, look, it's possible this is a circuit. Something can interfere. Something can screw with how this thing works. But I can't see any explanation for why on that particular day, under those particular circumstances, I got the reading that I got. Now, let's talk a little bit about your thoughts on that reading, because, as you know, I came back and I sent you a picture of the display, and we have corresponded a lot about how this thing worked. I'm very particular about using it correctly. What were your thoughts and feelings about that reading that I got?
That's totally incredible. There's no explanation for it using regular off-the-shelf school textbook theories. It should not happen. I've taken great pains in the design to protect against overvoltage interference from, like I said, EMI. The cable shielded, the internal oscillators. They have the can. They're inside of the metal can as they come off the shelf. Their temperature spec is well, the thing is, you verified that exact unit over time and for temperature. So, yeah, there's no explanation other than actual difference in time rate.
And now this particular model, and again, you started working on this concept in 2004. When did you actually get this model refined, the one that I have and the one that I'm using right now?
Okay, well, I let it sit on my shelf for many years. Okay, so, until I think it was the X-Files episode that keyed it in again or whatever, but I realized a few years ago that the technology existed to make one that I could sell for a reasonable amount of cash. And, I'm never sure if anybody would be interested in purchasing it, but I realized it was possible to build, so that kind of became irresistible to me to build it. And besides, I wanted a unit that I could produce enough of to take readings continually.
And you told me that you have been running at least a couple of these things, just like the one that I have, for months now already. Is that right? And just as a test in the background in California?
That's right. It did not add very much to the cost to put in something called an RS-485 interface. And the DT meter will respond to commands over RS-485. And you can program it to respond only to one address. So you can hook up a number of these on the same lines, and a computer can talk to them. So there's a computer on the market called a Raspberry Pi. It's an experimenter's computer. And it's pretty much all set up for remote operation, and it doesn't go to sleep. So it's reasonably easy, straightforward to program it to talk to the DT meter. So I set one up in a place called Kelseyville, California, and there's two DT meters there, one at right angles to the other, and they're continually monitored and logged, except when I forget to check on it and the power goes out. So, when that happens, I lose data. But they're pretty much monitored 24/7, and I have bunches of data, and I have never seen a reading like you've got. The highest I've got is like about 7. Microseconds is the largest event that I've seen, and yours is 25.
Okay, well, I'm glad you said that. Let's talk a little bit about that. And again, it's totally fine for us to geek out here. I actually thought I'd written down my measurement, but you might even remember it. I don't know. But okay, well, let's talk about the display. Okay, the display is it's like a calculator display for people who don't know. It is 0 point, and then it has 8 zeros, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's just talk about the basics. What if you're looking at that display, 0.00000000, what are we looking at, and what does that tell us?
Okay, well, the design was to make it have more digits than the stability is there on the oscillator. The actual spec of the oscillator that I'm using is 20 parts per million, and it is a 1 megahertz oscillator. And that is guaranteed throughout the full temperature range of the oscillator.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that gives you an idea of the maximum amount of variation, which would show up as the last three digits, all 0 and a 2 and the next one. So 0.00002. Anyway, 20 microseconds. Okay, that would be throughout the whole temperature variation from, I've forgotten the exact numbers of the temperature. But, so anyway, the last couple of digits, the main purpose of those is to tell that it's still running and performing. Because you notice the seconds per second on the top line, the last two digits are always changing. And the next line down is the peak reading. So without those extra digits, you may not know whether something has went wrong with the meter or not, because you wouldn't notice any change for a while until the peak got updated. But with those extra digits, even though they have very little meaning, you can tell that it's performing as normal.
And, of course, if there is a negative sign there, then it means the signal has slowed, meaning that, theoretically, time has slowed. And if there's not a negative, then that means that, you know, the opposite has happened, that time has sped up, correct?
Yes, in relation to the sensor unit.
Okay. So now, so my reading again, just for, and again, it's totally fine for us to get into these technical details. My reading was a peak here of 0.00002491. Now, I am not an expert when it comes to measuring time. In fact, you've taught me a lot about this, frankly. But I have been telling people that I measured an anomaly that was, you know, like a 20 microsecond slowdown. And I've described that as being something like taking a second and slicing it into 100,000 pieces and then 20 of them slowed down. But I would like for you to give everybody a much more accurate description of the reading that I received, please.
Okay. It's 25 pulses per second. The meter measures seconds per second. And the peak reading is what you have the reading on. So the seconds per second line on the top would have gone up to that value and then gone back down. So as far as the magnitude of it, let me ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
When after the reading, did you notice what the top line was reading over a period of time?
Well, I do have video footage of that. So I'd have to go back and look at my video because I kept the video camera on it most of the time. But, you know, in this one particular still that I'm looking at, the top line is all zeros except for a 2 and 3 on the extreme right-hand side.
Yeah, okay. I have that picture as well.
Mm-hmm.
It means that the peak reading was not sustained for a long period of time.
Right. It was just a boom, just a moment when I saw that happen.
Yeah. Okay. It's difficult for me to explain that much about the magnitude of the reading, but one thing's for sure, it should not have happened at all. So it's a pretty significant reading.
And so, and how would you describe that? Like, what is that reading? Instead of me saying, "Oh, it's a I got a 20 microsecond slowdown," how would you phrase that?
Well, I'd say 25 microseconds because of the rounded up. But I mean, for me as an engineer, I deal with microseconds and milliseconds all day, so it's pretty familiar.
And so if I say to you right now, I got a reading of 25 microseconds slowing down, is that accurate? Is that an appropriate thing for me to say as a description of this?
Well, you should include per second.
Okay, so I would say, so like 20, we'll say 25 microseconds per second?
That's right. Yeah, that would be the most correct thing to say.
Okay. Now, you know, when the people around the world have responded, as you know, with overwhelming sort of, you know, emotion and input and thoughts. And when it comes to those critics, there's this one fella who says, this is just noise. This is just noise. What would you say to that guy?
I would say that it's pretty well protected against just noise. Both circuits, they have overvoltage protection. The sensor unit has its own internal regulator that after it's protected against overvoltage, it regulates precisely to a voltage, and it sends it through a shielded cable that's well terminated. And you know, I don't know how to respond better than that. It should never have happened. If it had been intermittent cable problem, you can see what would happen if you pull the cable out. It would start beeping instantly, and the reading would go crazy, which did not happen. I remembered a way to put it into perspective. With our technology, the satellites, the difference in time rate between the satellite and here on Earth is about 20 microseconds per 24-hour period. Okay, so 20 microseconds per second is something that we don't have the ability to do.
So basically, then, you know, people who want to criticize this, people who are looking to play devil's advocate, like if you were in their shoes, if you were one of those folks who's a lawyer for the fact that, well, this is nothing notable, I'm just a sensationalist, you know, I'm a guy who's just out there trying to get publicity or whatever. If you wanted to criticize this reading, what do you think is the most credible criticism for the way the DT meter works?
Well, I don't have a good criticism, but it in the ideal case, it would be an area to where you could go away and come back and repeat the reading over and over.
Mm-hmm.
But since we don't have the ability to make this reading happen, and since you've used this meter continually over and over again and never gotten that sort of reading, you've kind of proved the reliability of the device that you have. I've designed the device to be as reliable as within the present technology and the price range, which is very reliable. It should be very reliable, and I've been running these for months without any reading like that. So I'm pretty solid that it's an actual time rate difference from location to location. And for me, that's not even the question. The question is what caused it, and that's what I would really be interested in finding out.
Well, you know, you're reading my mind, because you know that's ultimately where all these conversations go. When people are interviewing me, they're saying, "What do you think caused it?" And I'm sure you've heard some of my explanations. People who listen to this podcast, they've heard me, you know, use my imagination. But let me ask you, Ronald. I mean, what are some of your ideas? And feel free to just, you know, go out on a limb and get creative here. Like, what are some possibilities for what created this?
Well, there was a guy named Hutchison, and I don't know if you know the story or not.
You're talking about John Hutchison?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I've interviewed John Hutchison, absolutely.
Oh, wow, okay. Well, he built some machines that is a possibility to, you know, would be very interested to see if he can take a DT meter and create a machine that you turn it on and it has a seconds per second difference in time rate between having the machine on and having the machine off.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at what he's done is he's used high voltage and microwave energy and what you're describing with the lights that are visible. One possibility is that there's underground seismic activity that causes a piezoelectric effect that could possibly make a time rate difference. You know, this is all total speculation. Nobody's got one of these repeatable devices that, or at least nobody's talking about any.
And I am the first person who, and I've been saying this, but I just want you to say it for the record. I'm the first field investigator who got to take one of these out and do this research. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
And so, but I know that I am the first of many, because now people are starting to understand the implications here. And how many of these have you made altogether?
Total of 12 or 15.
Okay, so less than
20. All of them are sold out except for the last three.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that people have already contacted me, at least two or three people, and they're out there, they're using these things, and I really believe that whatever is causing these anomalies, that we are going to measure more and more of them very soon over the next 2 years. How do you feel about that?
I'm really hopeful. It would be so awesome to have somebody write me and say, I've got a machine. I turn this thing on and I get 50 microseconds per second, and I turn it off and it goes away.
Mm-hmm.
I can do that all the time. I mean, that would totally tickle me, because I've tried to make such a thing and have not been successful.
Mm-hmm.
There's rumors of rotating magnetic fields and experiments that were done in the UK with superconductive disks that are rotating, and you hear all these things, and I'd really like to have some data, and that was mostly the purpose of making this meter, is to get some data.
Now, obviously, throughout your life, you have worked on many, many different kinds of projects that have not been presented to the public. Is this sort of your crowning achievement as far as that's concerned, or do you have some other stuff you're working on there?
I have a number of projects that have been waiting for me to get some time, and
mm-hmm.
I hope to spend some time on it. That's I don't know if I really want to go into that much.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. Yeah, I understand. As a matter of fact, when you sent, I asked you before this interview to send me a bit of a bio, and you've never done an interview before, right? This is your first interview. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And so, and one of the funny things in your email, you said basically, this is all I do. You know, I don't go out hiking or playing golf or whatever. I mean, you know, this is your thing. You know, you like to sit there and create circuits. This is your life, right?
That's true. That's what I've been doing all my life, and as a hobby, and as my main interest as well.
And so, now that you have seen your name all over the world, and the name of the DT meter all over the world, and all that. How does that make you feel to be a person who has created something that is obviously having these kinds of ripples throughout the research community?
Well, I never thought it would happen, and I'm totally tickled. That's just an incredible thing. That's the coolest thing I've ever done.
Well, you know, I've told you this privately, and I'll tell you again here. I am just so thrilled and honored that you thought of me first to send this to me to go out and use it and give me this opportunity. And, you know, it didn't turn out the way I thought it was going to turn out. I mean, I had this little fantasy that I would travel from Las Vegas up toward Area 51 and everything would be normal, 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 and then I get to Area 51 and the thing would go bonkers, and then I'd be able to turn around and say, yeah, hey, listen, folks, they're doing some weird stuff at Area 51. You know, that's what I was hoping would happen, but it didn't turn out that way. It turned out that I didn't get anything unusual around Area 51 in Groom Lake. It was just that little spot, that nondescript spot on the side of the road in the desert where I got this anomaly, and that in and of itself would have been pretty exciting. But when I found out that that spot was where so much had happened, that's when I realized, okay, this is more than coincidence. I mean, Ronald, when you see the video of me standing there next to a man who has a model in his hands of the gigantic triangular craft that was hovering over his head at that same spot where your meter pegged, so to speak, and this is an incident that goes back to 1996. I mean, how do you put all that together in your mind?
There's influences on space time, I think, that linger. People have these bizarre things that happen in crop circles, just as an example, and something has not only made the circle, but days later, people have effects that happen, like the batteries will drain and stuff like that. So it's possible that the space-time has affected the matter, and something like that is going on. But I got to say that of course that I would have sent it to you. I've been listening to you for many years, I actually talked with a person named Mobius who was trying to get one of my sensors, and I couldn't supply him one because of it was an experimental thing, and there was no commercial application. But I've always paid attention all these years, so you have a fan.
Well, I'm certainly glad that you picked me to send it to, and you knew that I would take it seriously. And also, I hate to beat a dead horse here, but I want everybody to realize that I didn't just get this thing from you and run out and start looking around. I contacted you and made sure I knew how to use it as well as possible, right?
Yeah. You sent me an email, and I sent you detailed instructions to every email. And it was not in my manual, My manual was written mostly that you set this up in your bedroom and have the sensor as far away in your yard that you can get it from you, and that was the way it was written. But when you mentioned that you were going to take it in the field, I wanted to have you understand that you should calibrate it with the two units together, and then bring the after the calibration, then bring the sensor out to a distance, and that way you can get the difference between the display unit and the meter. Because if you just have it calibrated with the cable already stretched out, it'll calibrate to zero, and you won't, you know, that's the reading that you'll get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, and so I did everything I could do, and so I really believe that this is a brand new, well, candle in the dark, so to speak, that will allow us to view these anomalies in a new way. And, of course, everybody asks about repeatability, and I say, well, look, I think that we'll get it, but it's kind of like looking for a rainbow, looking for a lightning strike. I don't know what the variables are here, but it wouldn't be special if it happened consistently and predictably, but eventually we'll perhaps find some patterns and correlations. So we're getting short on time here, but let me just ask you, having listened to me talk on numerous occasions about you and about your invention and about how I use this, now that this is your first actual interview, and I guarantee you there are lots of people around the world who are excited to hear directly from you, is there anything that you want to say, anything you want to correct, anything you want to emphasize, anything that you want to inspire people to do? Is, I mean, the floor is yours.
Okay. Well, if you're going to go hunting with one of these, I think it would be great to test it possibly near ancient sites.
Mm-hmm.
There's the ley lines and things like that that have not been explained. There's Richard C. Hoagland has had a similar device, but he used a tuning fork. It was different, but it would be interested to go back to maybe that same site. But I really couldn't tell you as far as what would be the best location. I mean, the most obvious things that people have read before is the chronometers on their aircraft as they flew through this greenish fog and arrived at a totally different time when they did not have enough fuel in the plane to arrive there. So I know that these time anomalies exist, and I hope that my meter is instrumental in taking some data on them.
And your website is dtmeter.com, dtmeter as in time differential rate, dtmeter.com. Is that the best way for people to learn more about you and this device and anything else?
Okay. Remember, there's no hyphen. It's dtmeter, all one word.
Okay, dtmeter.com. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, dtmeter.com with no dash in the middle or hyphen or anything.
And, of course, people who listen to this podcast ought to know that if they go to joshuapwarren.com, they can click the tab there that says Gallery of the Strange, and I have all kinds of weird topics, and one of them is the Vegas Interstate Time Anomaly, which is what I originally called this. It didn't catch on. Nobody cared about that. They just call it the Time Warp. But still, if you click that, it's got all the updates on this, including the links to Ron's work and to all the other, you know, sort of supplemental material. But, you know, Ronald, I got to tell you, you, sir, represent the essence, the spirit of the true explorer, the true researcher, the true pioneer. And I love the fact that, you know, you have the imagination to think of what it takes to discover something new, and you're able to condense that down into something practical that can actually accomplish a physical goal. And what I can tell you, being the center of attention for all of this, is that 88% of everything that is coming directed toward me and vicariously to you is positive. People are excited. People, this makes sense to them. And the rest of them are people who just, they're looking for some reason to just be critical. And I find them all valuable, frankly. And I think that, you know, by you doing this interview, you've answered a lot of those questions. You've made it clearer about, you know, where you're coming from. And you're also very responsive. So if people want to email you, is your email address easily accessible at dtmeter.com, or do you want to give out an email address as well?
Yeah, it's on there. If you want, I can give it out.
Well, if it's on there, that's fine. You know, it's better to have folks go to dtmeter.com and
It'll refer you to. Sorry to talk over you, but it'll refer you to rhwebco.com, which is Ron Heath's web company. But the URL dtmeter I bought to forward to the page where the manual is kept, and my book is on there too. So.
Well, now that you're retiring, I hope that you're really, really bored, because I have a lot of ideas for things that I want you to do. How does that
cool. Hey, always interested to hear about new projects to build. I've got a long list.
I'm sure you do. All right. Well, again, you're great. I commend you for everything. And what can I say? The clock has got us. But thank you so much for appearing on the program with me today, sir.
Oh, you're welcome, and thanks for the opportunity to tell people about my DT meter.
You're very welcome. And everyone, once again, if you go to joshuapwarren.com, no period after the P, joshuapwarren.com, just click that link to Gallery of the Strange, and you'll see the heading that says Vegas Interstate Time Anomaly, and that's where I will be posting updates. So that's it for this particular podcast. Thank you for listening. Thank you for staying curious. And I will talk to you again soon.